Thank you for attending session 136, titled An Anthropic Theodicy. Where there is a loving, all-powerful God, must the natural world be as violently destructive of life as our world is? This session is being recorded. You will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. We encourage you to also purchase other Sunstone merchandise or make a donation to Sunstone to help support these amazing events. This session is 60 minutes long. We ask that both audience and presenters keep within that framework of the time so that we can allow for the next session to start on time. As a courtesy to other presenters and our attendees, we ask that immediately after this session, you clear the room and speak outside so other presentations can begin preparation for the next session. A little bit about this presentation. Natural disasters such as earthquakes spread misery, especially affecting the most vulnerable. How God allows this to happen remains a major obstacle to people's faith. Could it be these are a necessary part in keeping a planet like the Earth inhabitable? This presentation will explore the following argument. One, do you want me to not say that part? Okay, we'll let you explain it as you present. Lex Newman is a professor of philosophy at the University of Utah. He specializes in early modern philosophy, especially Descartes and Locke. David D. Allred is a professor of physics and astronomy at Brigham Young University in Provo. He has his PhD in physics and physical chemistry from Princeton University. We will turn the time over to our presentation.
Thank you. We're going to be going back and forth talking, so rather than pushing each other out of the way, we're just going to sit and be comfortable.
Okay, can you hear us from there, from back there now?
You need to talk right up to your mouth.
All right, you're going to have to pass it back and forth. Thank you.
All right, so let's start with a brief history of the problem of evil, and some efforts at solution.
Yeah, it's on, and you're really going to have to put it up here like you're a pop singer.
Like, we're going to keep that on that side.
No, you got to
keep having to.
All right.
This should work, I think. So, let me start with the classical formulation of the problem of evil. The problem arises from the hypothesis of not just any old creator, but of one that's supposed to be both all good and all powerful. And here are a couple of clear statements of the problem from people who've written about it. The philosopher David Hume writes, is God willing to prevent evil but not able? Then is he impotent? Is he able but not willing? Then is he malevolent? Is he both able and willing? Whence then is evil? And a passage from the writer C.S. Lewis that has very similar reasoning. If God were good, he would wish to make his creatures perfectly happy. And if God were almighty, he would be able to do what he wished. But the creatures are not happy. Therefore, God lacks either goodness or power or both. So, to make the problem a little more concrete, consider some notorious examples of evil arising from nature: earthquakes, tsunamis, volcano. And these have been much discussed in the history of this problem. In the face of such calamities, it's tempting to conclude either that our world is not, after all, the handiwork of an all-good creator, or else that the creator, if there is one, was not, after all, powerful enough to design a world absent these calamities. As the noted philosopher and mathematician Leibniz, who's one of the prominent writers on the problem of evil historically, as he writes, it must be confessed that there is evil in this world, which God has made, and that it was possible to make a world without evil, or even not to create a world at all, for its creation has depended on the free will of God. Whence then evil, as David Hume asks? As will emerge, we're focusing on basic laws of nature. Right? From the standpoint of natural science and much of philosophy, what our world is like, including that it has earthquakes, is a function of basic laws of nature, in which case we're asking, why do we find ourselves in a world that has basic laws of nature that give rise to these kinds of calamities? David, now?
Okay, so what we want to do now is talk a little tiny bit about where this sits
in LDS theology. But first of all, I'd like to talk about the name Anthropic. This actually is used a lot in physics and other natural sciences when we think about the universe as it exists, with humans here to observe it. And I'd like to relate really quickly a brief story about this. The physicist Fred Hoyle, who is known for the steady state theory, if any of you are old enough to know that before the Big Bang theory, called up some of his friends who are nuclear physicists and said, is there a resonance in the carbon-12 nucleus at 4 million electron volts? And they said, not that we know of. And he said, go look for it. And they did, and it was there. And he said, they asked him, how did you know? And he said, because the universe is here. What did he mean by that? What he meant was, is stars without that resonance would not be able to produce carbon in the heavier elements. But the heavier elements are here because we're all here. So Fred Hoyle knew that there had to be that resonance in the carbon 12 nucleus. And physicists have noticed as they went along that there are a lot of other happy coincidences that allows us to have a universe in which human intelligence is possible. One of the ones is, and the questions abound, nuclear reactions occur in sub-picosecond time frames, and yet evolution and stars have to burn billions of years. How did this happen? So this has led to the Anthropic principle, which is, hey, guys, if it wasn't that way, then there'd be nobody here to observe that it wasn't that way. So we're going to talk about what does it mean to have a world in which it had to be set up so that humans could be here. Now let's go to the next picture here. So here are various views that people have had from a theistic point of view about God's sovereignty over creation. We could postulate one of these might fit closely to where each one of us sits, and maybe as LDS, your own feelings on this have evolved, or like mine have, or are in one of these places. Let's read them quickly. God creates the universe and its laws of nature, emphasizing the sovereignty of God. Genesis 1:1 starts off with that. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth, not just the earth, but the heavens as well. Or God creates the living organisms in a pre-existing universe with preset laws of nature. Okay? And many LDS find themselves agreeing with this. We have, as God is, man may become. Or as man is, God once was. As God is, man may become. And emphasizing that perhaps humans could be partners in a creation of worlds with other humans on them. And that may be where people find themselves. Or with the last one, that God emerges in a pre-existing universe already stocked with living organisms, that it's just a matter of bringing the humans into that world. All right, but there's some problems with these approaches. We have to ask some questions. And they're relevant to our particular question, which is, okay, so why would God create a universe with laws of nature giving rise to such destructive natural phenomena as earthquakes and destructive volcanoes? Or we could ask the question, why would God create living organisms? Because God has the choice. If the universe had to have these laws of nature, why would we do that? Or last of all, if we have it already stocked with living organisms, why would God allow humans to continue to exist in that universe with laws that give rise to destructive natural phenomena like earthquakes? All right, let's go on then.
So a little more on this brief history of the problem and efforts at solution. Since Leibniz, who coined the term theodicy, efforts at solving the problem of evil have come to be called theodicies. And most of those that have arisen or that you may have heard of could be grouped under what we could call greater goods theodicies. Leibniz wrote, "The best plan is not always that which seeks to avoid evil, since it may happen that the evil is accompanied by a greater good. Therefore, it is sufficient to show that a world with evil might be the better world." So one way to frame this up is sort of visually here. Imagine a couple of worlds, right? And suppose they've got all the same things in them: dogs, trees, chocolate, chairs, lectures, and so on. And then in the second world, we add one extra ingredient, and it's something we'd all agree are goods. Well, in that case, this is an easy outcome. World two is the better one. But let's make it a little bit more difficult. Suppose world two has, over and above world one, not only some extra goods, but some extra evil. Now it's a little harder to ask, is that the better world? But let's complicate the picture a little bit more. Suppose that good and evil are an inseparable package deal. You can't get the one without the other. So to take an example, suppose you think that courage and heroism are good things, that they make the world better. But notice you can only have acts of courage in the face of danger. So then you'd have to have both danger and courage, or neither. Now, maybe that's not your favorite example. Maybe you think you'd rather have neither. That's not going to be our example. But that's an example of what we mean by a package deal that has some good and evil. And then when all is said and done, we expect that if there's an all-good, all-powerful God, and here's how I picture it. This is from the movie Bruce Almighty, right? Morgan Freeman played God. God creates the better world. So is our world like that? Is the evil in our world needed for some greater good? Well, here let's make a quick distinction between what has been called moral evil and natural evil. And roughly the distinction is this. Moral evil is suffering caused by voluntary human choices, whereas natural evil is suffering caused by natural events such as earthquakes, volcanoes, tsunamis, and the like, events that at least ordinarily aren't thought to be traceable to human choice. Well, you can apply these greater good strategies to both of these kinds of evil. So, for example, though it's not what we want to focus on, in the case of moral evil, philosophers and theologians have appealed to what you could call a free will theodicy. The idea is to have a genuinely free agent, you have to have the possibility that agent will make choices you wouldn't have wanted the agent to make. Evil choices, indeed. Can't have one without the other. And then the thought is the world's better with both than with neither. Well, our interest is in natural evil. Again, these big calamities. And the problem for us then is those calamities, and they're going to be the ones we're focusing on, all involve a common denominator, plate tectonics. And at least at first glance, that looks like a bad thing, a world with plate tectonics. Why would God have put us in a world like that? What good... got question marks there, right? What good do plate tectonics serve? And that now is our background, and we want to talk a bit about our theodicy. We have a kind of game changer, we think, based on new developments in science. So David's already explained this term anthropic, and so we're co-opting it here, and our division of labor, we've got sort of one step in our argument's philosophical. I'm going to ramble a bit on that. The other one's really about science. David's going to ramble a bit on that. So let me do the philosophical thesis. And here it is, that responsible free agency requires a law-governed world. And here what I'm trying to make the case for is the following package deal. That if you want humans with responsible free agency, you've got to have a law-governed world. And then as we hand the mic over to David, he'll explain the specific laws you're going to need. So on this, why would we need to have this as a package deal? And what do I mean by responsible free agency, or what you might call rational free agency? I mean, first, that we have free agency, and second, that we have it in a manner that allows us to bear responsibility for our actions. By law governed, I mean something like that, for example, water always boils at 100 degrees Celsius, not sometimes, that is at sea level, right? It's kind of a tyrannically enforced law. It's just always going to be enforced. That's what it is to be in a law governed world, at least what we're talking about inanimate objects. Some other examples of laws, fire burns, right? Gravity pulls objects downward and so forth. Laws give us predictability, right? We're able to predict that if we do something with water, you'll get a certain outcome. A pot of hot water to make tea, or something that could injure a baby. And we can plan our actions accordingly, but we couldn't plan our actions. We couldn't act responsibly absent the predictability that laws give us. So, for example, predictably, fire burns, even burning the flesh of babies. So in planning our actions, we take steps to protect children from hot stoves and scalding hot water. Predictably, objects fall due to gravity, including human babies that fall off balconies. So we plan accordingly. What would the world be like if it weren't law-governed? Imagine that it was just chaotic. So if you pushed somebody off a ledge, on some occasions they would fall in accord with gravity. On other occasions they might float gently to the earth in a manner that was fun for them. Or if instead that body remained on a ledge, maybe on some occasions the ledge remained stable, on other occasions the ledge disintegrated. That in such a world that's chaotic like that, we could not have planned action. And without planned action, we couldn't have responsibility. Sort of summarizing the key point here, responsible free agency requires a law-like universe. Moral responsibility requires predictability. To be able to act responsibly, there must be predictable consequences to our free actions. For example, we need to be able to foresee that doing X will lead to Y. But predictability requires law-governedness. C.S. Lewis, writing about these issues, gave us this. The inexorable laws of nature, which operate in spite of human suffering or desert, which are not turned aside by prayer, seem at first sight to furnish a strong argument against the goodness and power of God. I'm going to submit that not even omnipotence could create a society of free souls without at the same time creating a relatively independent and inexorable nature. That God can and does on occasions modify the behavior of matter and produce what we call miracles is part of the Christian faith. But the very conception of a common and therefore stable world demands that these occasions should be extremely rare. So segueing here, again, we've talked about why this is an inseparable package deal. We want to focus on the second item in there, the law governedness. And David's going to talk about why, based on recent developments in science, those laws would have to include plate tectonics.
Okay, so here's the deal, guys. We've got the idea of the anthropic fine-tuning of the universe, that certain laws have to be there in order for us or any intelligent, corporally based entity to exist. And I mentioned the case of carbon being able to be formed by stars. But there's a whole variety of them, and they do come as a package deal. So when you have a universe where stars can form carbon-12 and oxygen and all the other elements, you're also going to have certain laws of nuclear attraction, which are going to produce all the other consequences as well. You can't get one without the other. So let's now turn to the case of the Earth itself on which we live on. Because as we're learning more, and plate tectonics is that where we are right now? Or do we want to go back to the other one?
Up to you.
Yeah, let's go back to the other one here. Yeah, that it's more fine-tuned. That's what we've been finding over the years. Physics has came to its mathematical maturity 300 years ago, before some of the other sciences. In my lifetime is when geology got its Newton kind of aha moment, and that was the discovery of plate tectonics, ocean floor spreading, subduction, and all the other kinds of phenomena that we'll talk about in just a second. As we've gone along, we're getting pushed towards the right on this diagram. It's looking like the universe is more and more fine-tuned to allow the kinds of planets where human life can exist. Now, people talk about, oh, we'll find life on other planets. But if we find a bacteria, that's not interesting, okay? I mean, it's interesting to scientists, but what we're talking about is worlds that can be stable enough and endure long enough for complex life to evolve. Humans, animals, dogs, cats, and particularly vascular plants of the kind that live on the surface of the earth, trees and the like. So let's go now to, like we say, plate tectonics. Let's talk about what's happened here. We have to start, first of all, billions of years ago with the sun, okay, or any star, and planets around it. If you get too close to a star, you'll get too hot. It just makes sense. If you get too far from the star, you get too cold. Somewhere in between, they call it the Goldilocks zone, yes, you'll be just right. And there'll be water on the planet and the opportunity for life to develop and get more complex. The trouble is this, and that's what we're going to show in the next slide. Okay, stars' output are not constant with time. The sun at the beginning was 40% dimmer than it is right now. Please go to the next one. And as it increases in brightness, these habitable zones move outward. So the question was, and it was formulated a large number of decades ago, how did the Earth stay warm during all these eons of time? And this diagram, okay, we got to have a diagram if it was a physics talk, captures part of that. So we don't have my laser pointer. Oh, yes, we have my laser pointers here with me. Of course we have laser pointers. Or do we? I don't know.
Or we can do this.
No, I'll just point at them here. Okay? So right here we have this red line, the change in solar luminosity with time. And you read against the right-hand side to see where it is. If we have a planet like the moon that doesn't have an atmosphere, it should have started really cold and right now still be really cold. If you put an atmosphere on a planet, right now we know that the atmosphere that we have on the planet with its present composition produces a planet which works well for humans. And that's clear on the right there. But on the left, we should have been about a minus 20 Celsius as the average temperature of the planet. And it should be have been one big snowball. But people have done the work and looked at their standards. We didn't have thermometers anciently, but we have chemical reactions that take place, and people can study at what temperature the Earth was through eons, and it was the same temperature it is right now. Well, how can you get that? How can you get the Earth to have been at that temperature all that time? Well, if we had a lot more greenhouse gases anciently in eons past, yeah, we could have kept it that warm. So if you can go to the next slide, okay? Planets keep warm by having lots of CO2 and other greenhouse gases and then letting them go away at just the right rate. Okay, how do you get them to go away at just the right rate without evoking, hey, we're going to send down angels and keep changing it all the time? The answer is something that people realized about 30 years ago. It's a trade-off where you can start with silicates, with calcium silicate, magnesium silicate, they're basalt, and have those change into carbonates. The carbonates suck the carbon dioxide out of the planet's atmosphere. So this is the equation. We have it right there. Water plus CO2 makes carbonic acid. Carbonic acid helps weather rocks. The weathering of rocks releases ions, including calcium ions, and those down in the ocean eventually will get to a high enough concentration, even without life, that you'll form limestone. If you have life, you do it a little bit sooner and a little bit more organized way. And that's all fine. That takes carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. But suppose the planet gets too cold. You're kind of locked up. Well, there's something else happening at the same time you're using up carbon dioxide, and that is that volcanoes are releasing carbon dioxide. But if you don't have plate tectonics, if you just have a volcano in one hot spot and it just keeps producing puffs of magma throughout eons, that's what happened on Mars, you'll get eventually exhausting all of the volatile gases that are in the reservoir of that rock, and you're done, okay? You have to have some way to replenish the reservoir that's under where the volcano is taking place with water and carbon dioxide, and that's plate tectonics, okay? So there on the right, we have in our circle, we have something moving the limestone underneath the volcano. So let's talk a little bit more about plate tectonics, all right? So that'll be on our next slide, okay? So there we summarize it. if the volcano spits out excess CO2, or we have maybe the sun get brighter, then the Earth will warm up a little bit. And when that happens, there's more evaporation, more rainfall and erosion. We break down the rocks more quickly. We form more CO2, and calcium carbonate, and that pulls the CO2 out of the atmosphere. So this is a negative feedback, which causes stability then. On the other hand, if the planet gets too cold for whatever reason, then the CO2 stays in the ocean longer. There's less rainfall and less erosion. There's less limestone form, but the volcanoes, if we have some way of replenishing the stockpile, keep putting out CO2 till eventually we get enough CO2 that the atmosphere and the oceans are warmer and we go back into equilibrium. So that's sort of the idea people have had about how the Earth stayed habitable over 4 billion years. Now, the very first part is still a mystery. People are still worrying about that one. How did it happen? Were the oceans dark or things like that? Okay, but we got to understand that part of that reaction that we talked about, besides making that nice calcium ion that later gets used up as a carbonate, is it makes SiO2. Silicon dioxide is a light rock. Now, it's hard to think about rocks being light, but compared to basalt, the rocks like granite that have a lot of quartz in them are a lot lighter, lightweight. And these things make something that's wonderful for planets that are going to have humans on it. And that's the continental crust, okay? Because it's lighter than the basalt, and it sort of, go ahead, sort of floats above the mantle rocks and is higher than it. Now, we haven't had the same amount of continental crust through the eons. Most of it appeared in the last 2 billion years, okay? Seems like a long period of time. It's not so long. And that process, like we said, produces continents that are now above the sea, and that's a good thing, okay? What else do we have that is good, okay? So plate tectonics provides stable land above sea level, okay? That's the continental land, and that is the most productive area on Earth in a biological sense, okay? Plate tectonics also keep, or tectonics in general, keep you from having the land disappear by erosion into the sea. It would only take a few tens of millions of years to wash the mountains into the oceans if we had no tectonic processes pushing them back up. Bioproductivity occurs because we have lands now for plants to grow on that are stable. Also, necessary nutrients don't get buried and are gone forever. They get recycled in a variety of ways, one of which we're going to talk about. Okay? And thus, life, even in the sea, prospers because of the tectonic processes. Okay? Plate tectonics is a good thing. But what else do they do? Okay? The other shoe. Let's listen. Okay? Okay. So tectonic processes are like a soup pot. When you heat up from a fluid from below, it will start to convect. And here we're showing the mantle rocks convecting. They're going up in one place. When they get to the crust, right here in the middle, there's the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. The rock separate. The material separates in two directions, and it goes along. It's creating new oceanic crust all the time. But for that to be stable, you have to have a place where part of that crust dives down under other crust. And that's what we're showing over on the right-hand side where we have a process going along called subduction and a subduction zone. Okay, we pull old crust into the mantle again. Now we're going to look at a picture of the Earth as it exists right now and where those zones are. So the areas where the arrows point outward are areas where new crust is being formed. Those are those red areas. And then these blue areas, like underneath Indonesia or over by Japan or down by Chile, we have arrows pointing together. And that's where subduction is taking place, where the old oceanic crust is being pulled under the Earth and will now allow that carbon dioxide to come out to keep the Earth stable. Okay, so here shows us a picture on the next slide of where earthquakes occur. The two pictures are remarkably similar, okay? In fact, the really big earthquakes occur one-on-one with where subduction's occurring, The ones that kill lots of people, all right? That's those places, okay? But not only do you get earthquakes, you also, for no extra cost, like the late night show, you get tsunamis, okay? No extra cost. And those are even more deadly a lot of times than earthquakes. And you get stratovolcanoes. Okay, stratovolcanoes, next slide, are really pretty. And we're going to see some pictures of them. But let's understand why they form. So we're going to go through a plate tectonic detail right now. This diagram has the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, but I want to focus over here on the left side. So if you can give us down a few sides, okay. We've got the land being pulled under the earth, and as it does, it's wet, and it has carbonates on it, and the heat is breaking those down. They're light rocks. Buoyancy, just like a balloon going upward, causes them to start going upward. The water and CO2 is also extremely hot, and it dissolves rock into itself, okay? And that dissolved rock is what we call magma. You think of magma as, you know, molten rock. It's really a solution that's 99% rock and 1% water. But it still is, the 1% water is really important. As it goes upward through old crust, its composition changes. And it now starts to have more and more of that light rock, which is silica-based. Now, silica-based rock, that magma, is different than the rock that you get in Hawaii. Hawaii is out there in the middle of the ocean. The magma that comes up flows like water. You've seen pictures of it going down to the ocean, making this wonderful waterfall. That isn't what you get all the time in stratovolcanoes over continents, okay? Or places like Japan, which are becoming continents. In those particular cases, you get a magma which is so thick that it's like taffy. Have any of you ever made peanut brittle and put the baking soda in the peanut brittle and had it foam up? The bubbles don't come out really well. That's what it's like in this kind of lava that's coming out. It's a necessary consequence from the laws of nature that you're going to get a magma which is really kind of interesting. Okay? When it erupts, because of the viscosity, unless it has lots of time, the gases won't come out. And when they don't come out, you get an expansion of 1,000 times. Okay, so you got gases that under so much pressure, they're at liquid densities. And then when the lid gets taken off the shaken bottle of Coke, it expands 1,000 times over. And that produces an explosion. An immense amount of ash are propelled into the Earth's atmosphere and down the volcano slopes. Okay, so now we're going to see some beautiful stratovolcanoes. There's Mount Fuji. Gorgeous, okay? There's Vesuvius, which Janice and I recently visited. Sun coming up over it. Just gorgeous little things. But because of the viscosity that's in them, we're going to get these. If we have an earthquake, which causes a landslide, the pressure comes off the lid on the volcano, the magma degasses explosively. Now, I took some of this straight from Wikipedia, which we know is all true. Okay. In science, it tends to be a little better, a lot of them. Explosive volcanoes, eruptions at subduction zones, have posed the greatest hazard to civilization. Okay? You think it's, no, the Huns coming across the Danube. Nope. That's not it. Nope. You guessed wrong. Okay, so there seems to be no limit how big these explosions are. We have some every few years. We have Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines in the last 30 years. And there are others. But if you just integrate over time, they get bigger and bigger. Not as common, but they are very large. Okay, and they are a threat. Okay, let's see what the next slide tells us about that. Okay, consequences of such ones. If you are nearby, that's what people use to count as to why volcanoes were terrible, would be the poisonous gas, the ashes, the pyroclastic flow. Imagine a river flowing at 200 or 300 miles an hour, and its temperature is 400 or 500 degrees Celsius. And it comes down the slope and hits you. That's what happened to this poor woman in Pompeii. That's not her. That's where they poured the plaster into a place in the ash that was hollow. But there had been a woman there who was sheltering her hands from the ash in the air, and then she was hit by this and killed in an instant. Okay? This is terrible. Okay? What also happens nearby is the poisoning of the land from too much ash, and we get something called, which we could call a volcano winter. There's so much ash in the atmosphere of the Earth that it knocks gases, sunlight into the outer parts of the, off from the Earth. The temperature on the Earth goes down. In places like Russia that are marginal climates have famines caused by frost and people die, okay? You get the spreading of diseases, okay, because you have disorder and things going on. And then you get your warfare and your mass migrations, which historians have always reported but not had a good explanation why. Okay, so Laki is a volcanic rift in Iceland. In 1783, it erupted, and Nova said that there were between 1 million and 5 million people who died from the volcanic winter that ensued, a million at least in France. Okay. Indonesia, 1815, April, only 10 cubic kilometers of ash, or cubic meters, miles of ash went up, but it killed in the neighboring area 100,000 people. At least 100,000 people died in Europe of famines, typhus, and riots, and many more. We also got the novel Frankenstein out of that, for those of you who are literary. Okay, it aggravated the spread of a new strain of cholera, which emerged in Bengal in 1816. It became the first cholera pandemic of the last 200 years, okay? But we also got better crop yields in the decades after that because ash is a finely divided mineral. It's a fertilizer, okay? It's just you don't want too much of it. All right, let's go next. So plate tectonics are incredibly destructive to individuals. Remember the people killed in Pompeii and all the other places. They're also incredibly destructive to civilizations. This is Santorini. This is what finished off the Minoan civilization and led to a lot of other disorder in the ancient eastern part of the Levant. It can also be devastating to whole species. Now, a species, as humans, the death of someone we love is a tragedy. For a species, it's just a fact. But if you get 99.99999% of the individuals dead, then the species goes away. Okay. The Deccan traps, sometimes whole ecosystems, the Deccan traps are an area in India where we have 1.5 million square miles of lava erupted. This was about the same time as the extinction of the dinosaurs and probably helped kill them all off, okay? Yes, well, that's the point. Thank God. Paul is right. Thank God. Plate tectonics, violence, yields life and death. It seems to be a package deal, okay? Scientists are thinking about life on other planets, and you'll read papers. We think that on the following planet postulated that's going to have too rigid of a crust for plate tectonics to work, we could still maintain life. And other people read it and say, probably not. Okay, not complex life. So thus we've got that plate tectonics provide stable life above sea level, the continental crust. It enhances bioproductivity. It provides necessary nutrients. But it's got this other side. And that is, well, that's the point on why we think we have to have all this destruction. Now, you got to understand, a lot of the stuff about the stratovolcanoes and the large eruptions and their role in human civilization has only come out in the last 20 or 30 years as we've gotten better compiling of records from all over the Earth. So when I first read the argument for plate tectonics 20 years ago, this stuff about what it did in other places with the explosions hadn't fully been explored. So I'm going to guess that, yeah, this can change, but it's going to be more of in the line of, guys, this plate tectonic stuff is really bad news. But does it produce a better world?
Well, summarizing, and we're about done, we've talked about two central steps. First, the responsible free agency requires a law-governed universe. Package deal. You want a universe with us in it, going to have it be a law-governed world. David then talked about, second bullet here, in law-governed universes, only planets with plate tectonics are capable of sustaining advanced terrestrial life, including humans. Upshot, the package deal that includes both humans with responsible free agency and plate tectonics is a greater good. Well, you may, somebody may think it wasn't worth it, humanity wasn't worth it, but as long as you think there being a universe with us in it is worth it, it's going to have to be that we exist on a planet very much like the one that we find ourselves in. Now, this theodicy we've talked about here that we call an anthropic theodicy is limited in scope. There's all kinds of other evils that the theist needs to explain in order to have a full theodicy. But we focused on natural evils, and indeed we've focused on what has historically been regarded as the hardest cases of natural evil. So theists should take some hope and optimism here that if we can explain the hardest cases of natural evils, the other evils can be explained as well, though we don't pretend that there are worked out, detailed theodicies explaining just everything just yet. Thank you.
Okay, at this point, we can invite questions and comments, okay? So start right here. Could you come up? Would you be willing to come up? You raised your hand. Did you?
Is it better if we just summon?
Paul does. It's actually better if Alan does his own.
Well, I'm a chemist, so I guess that's useful. At least I know the scientific arguments. Just a comment here. I was noting Vicki and I went to Africa a couple years ago. And in studying for that, it was we discovered that the reason that Africa has always been kind of backwards in terms of civilization has been that there are, it's all one continental plate. The only two really fertile areas in Africa are the Nile Valley, which is a river valley, of course, and in parts of Ethiopia close to the Rift. And so one of the reasons that Africa is not generally a particularly fertile place is because there are no subduction zones close enough to refertilize, basically, the territory.
You only get it from what washes down.
What washes down.
Or
what,
the volcanoes on the rift that are producing,
they're producing it up.
Producing some nearby.
So that's a, you know, kind of auxiliary evidence that this actually works in the world that we have.
Yeah, amazing. People often think that jungles are productive. They're not particularly productive. That's why people don't live there much. Okay. All right, would you like to come up? Yes, and turn in desert when you cut them down, yeah.
Oh, say your name, too.
I'm Marie Blanchard, and my question has to do with the natural evil, which I've never thought of as evil. I'm a neophyte philosophically. I've always thought of that as suffering caused by natural law. But could you explain evil in the formal philosophical sense so that I can understand it?
Is it suffering?
Yeah. Well, evil and suffering are arguably separate. But there's a tendency to sort of conflate them and take any example of suffering and think of it as an evil. Of course, if the child didn't feel pain when its hand was on a hot stove, that would be the bad scenario. Feeling pain enables some survival. So I think the way you have to link this up to the problem of evil in citing instances of suffering, and philosophers who've written on this are the good ones, are pretty good about connecting this. Rather than just assuming that all examples of suffering or pain are evils, it's that they give rise to what somebody might think is an unjustified evil. And so some writers frame it up in terms of there being morally sufficient reasons for the suffering that we find ourselves encountering in this world. Most people won't think that stubbing your toe is a reason to think there's no God. But lots of people have thought that volcanoes are. So there's certainly going to be a spectrum of suffering and whether it counts as evil. I mean, even the atheist who doesn't think there are is objective good and evil can still point to suffering and say, I don't like it. Why wasn't our universe made without it? Even without even invoking the idea of evil. But the problem of evil has generally been thought to encompass various forms of evil, and we talked about moral and natural.
Is it okay if I call on Christian over there? Because he's one of the younger people in the room.
Not anymore.
It's been a while since I was the youngest person in the room. So I guess my comment is, simplifying it down, I don't buy it. I like your explanation for earthquakes, and it's a good one for sort of physical evil. There's also a great book by a guy named Francisco Ayala, who is both the president of the American Academy of Sciences and a Jesuit priest from Spain before he became one of the world's foremost evolutionary biologists, who wrote a book about this subject. It has a chapter on physical evil and also goes into much more detail about biological evil and how natural selection is a great thing because it sidesteps the problem of why everything has to kill everything else in order to get complex life and things evolving forward. And I sort of ran into the same problem, which is, for him, as a Catholic, God made these rules that in order to get a human, you have to have unspeakable suffering for billions of years in order to get complex life and carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and prevent snowball Earth. You have to have unspeakably horrific volcanic explosions. Now, as Mormons, we kind of sidestep that issue a little bit by saying God is also bound by natural law, that he can't just make up any rules for the universe that he wants to. But it's not clear to me that he couldn't, that an all-knowing and all-powerful God couldn't have come up with a better solution than death by volcano to the problem of no, to the problem of no complex life.
Okay, yeah, that's really good. And Christian, I expect that within the next 100,000 years, you will come up with a counterexample. Because that's what Latter-day Saints believe, right? We're going to become gods and we can do it better, right?
Right.